Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Head to Burleigh at the midpoint of Sherman and 51st, where it slices through 47th exactly, and you'll find an intersection of cultures. In one African-American-run business called My Barbershop, you'll hear a steady stream of hip-hop on Pandora. Right next door, you'll step into the Kosher Meat Club, and you'll find customers picking up kosher meats or chocolates or ordering food for weddings and celebrations.
Earlier this week on Morning Edition, we reported on how these businesses reflect the coexistence of the two groups in the neighborhood. But we wanted to further explore what each business brings to that neighborhood, and Lake Effect's Mayon Silver brings us the story.
Inside the door of the place called My Barbershop, owner Del Tatum stands at a maroon swivel chair doing what he has done for years, cutting hair. Today, one of his regular customers, Jackie, is getting her trim.
When you walk into a barbershop, you know what's going on by the owner and the tone of the barbershop. And this is comfortable, family, safe, you know. You have to worry about nothing coming in here.
All right, we earned it over the years.
Right.
Been here 20 years.
Del wanted to be a barber since childhood. So when he got the chance, he studied at MATC, apprenticed, then took over the shop. He has a no-nonsense yet friendly style. Barber Nathaniel Brown works for him and puts it this way.
Dale is a leader. Well, he's a business owner and, you know, he's cutting hair, so that means he's doing a lot with the public. So Dale is a good role model as far as when it comes down to, you know, a young black entrepreneur just having his own. So Dale is a good role model to a lot of youth.
Right now, two kids, preteen brothers Stavion and Stevie, sit patiently waiting. They are return customers. As they wait, Stevie explains what's so important about a haircut.
I mean, do you really care what your hair looks like? It's really important?
Yes.
And why is that?
Because it might look weird, and I don't like when it looks weird and how it feels.
And when it looks good, how do you feel?
I feel good.
While this answer may harken back to James Brown, barber Nathaniel Brown understands the importance of a good coif, but he explains that the services that My Barbershop provides goes beyond a haircut.
This is where you come and you get a lot of information from. We tell you to go to school. We tell you to get this hair groomed to make you look appropriate and presentable when you're going to do a job interview or something. We want to make sure as we groom you, we want to make sure we give you some positive information that may take you a long way.
And he says he grows from this kind of work as well.
It adds some wisdom. You can learn something from here. It's older folks, youngs. You know, it's multiple age of folks that come in here, so it's something always to learn.
For his part, Del is aware that the shop can play a role in helping kids like Stevie and Stavion.
We do whatever we can in the community. We partner with the Boys and Girls Club down the street sometimes if they're having events. There's a guy down the street, he runs a Father's Day picnic every year. We contribute our time and services to them, whatever we can in the community.
When I ask Nathaniel what the shop means to him, he says,
family. You know, once you do, it's like family. It's a family atmosphere.
It's a familiar refrain in the neighborhood.
And it's family oriented. My son works at the warehouse. My daughter-in-law does the candy store. My adopted
That's Marcia Eisenbach, who owns the Kosher Meat Club next door to the barbershop with her husband David. The store is a mainstay of Sherman Park's Orthodox Jewish community, and it's into its 40th year. The store's aisles are laden with kosher wines, cases of dairy and frozen foods, and a deli in back with a chocolate and candy section. The Eisenbachs like to get to know their customers. In fact, it's hard to walk into the store with Marcia without someone striking up a conversation with her.
When we bought the store,
hello, Marcia.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Good to see you.
Sampling.
Oh, that time again.
She takes me into the back kitchen area where employees are prepping food. One of those employees is Pacey Elbaum, Marcia's son's wife's brother, who explains what they cook back there.
Fish, chicken, salads. We do pastries, cookies, challah bread.
But it's the 100% kosher status that sets the store apart from other grocers in Milwaukee and even Wisconsin.
Kosher is a process of production. Basically, from the time it's manufactured through we get the ingredients till we use them and we bake them and the customer gets it in his hand, there's rabbinical supervision over every step of the way.
So there's rabbis lurking around all the time?
They're not lurking. They're not lurking. It's a standard. It's like in any company, anybody that opens a business, they have certain standards of what they're expecting. So, the, you know, manager's watching over to make sure they get the product they want. Our customers want kosher. So part of that process is having rabbis manage the facility and make sure that it's kosher.
Marcia says that the population of customers who want kosher food in Sherman Park is expanding.
It's grown. The Jewish community has grown. We were like 10, 12 Orthodox families. There's high school. There's a Jewish girls' high school, which is Jewish yeshiva. The ability to have young families move back has strengthened because there's what to offer now.
Customer Rabbi Avraham Kramer is checking out. He travels from the east side to shop there. And for him, the Kosher Meat Club is something more that the neighborhood offers.
You get all your basic food needs and a little love. And a little love. That might be more important.
A little love from both businesses on a busy Sherman Park street may be the key, along with another key ingredient. As barber Nathaniel Brown puts it,
when you come in the neighborhood and you got multi-different cultures, how folks gonna vibe and get along with one another is just by respecting one another. You respect their business like they respect this business. Like the kosher place over here, we respect them, they respect us. And that's how a community is built.
For Lake Effect, I'm Mayan Silver.
There are more stories about Sherman Park, including a history on how it became the diverse place it is, at WUWM.com.
Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For people dealing with mental illness, trauma, or other difficult life circumstances, there are many different forms of therapy professional counselors can use to help. Psychotherapy and other talk therapy techniques have been well used and accepted for more than 100 years.
But it's been much more recently that art therapy has come into its own in this country and taken its place among other more long-standing practices. There is an increasing number of art therapists practicing in Milwaukee, largely thanks to a growing program at Mount Mary University.
Five Milwaukee art therapists work out of a recently renovated space on South KK Avenue in Bayview. Bloom Center for Art and Integrated Therapies is headed by Emily Nolan, who was in the first doctoral class to come out of Mount Mary's program. We stopped by the studio on a recent Monday before any patients were there and spoke with Nolan and fellow therapists Ashley Smallwood and Caitlin Walsh. Thanks for having me here.
Lovely to have you.
Welcome. Welcome to Bloom. Thank you.
Well, so before we really get into what you do with your clients, I'm curious to have both of you kind of reflect on your life as an artist and why you feel a connection between art and helping people through what you help people through.
Well, I'll start with that. I fell in love with photography at a really young age, and I also, growing up, had a neighbor who was diagnosed with autism, and I started working with him when I was probably, I think, in seventh grade, volunteering. We were repatterning his brain. And I fell in love with the ability to, you know, spend time helping people that needed it. And he had no verbal communication, so it was often things like letter boards or computer screens or...
So you were not doing art therapy with him at that point?
Not at that time, no, but I was really drawn to the ability to help people. And again, not having verbal skills, you needed another outlet to do that. So as I got older, I got my degree in fine arts, and then from there kind of got lost on what to do and found art therapy and literally fell in love with the idea that you can connect art making, which was my background, with the ability to help people. So that's where it kind of blossomed for me, and that was probably 10 years ago that I found that. So I'm new to the field.
I was in a totally different career field until my late 20s. And
what were you doing?
I actually owned a shop on the east side, a knitting store, so it was still creative. I always had this feeling that I'd be a good therapist. And my mother was a therapist, and she kind of talked to me about what a long road it is, because it's really a long road. She just wanted to be real with me, not that I wouldn't be good at it. I think she always knew that. So I found the art therapy and I was like, oh my gosh, it was like a light bulb moment that all my credits would transfer, everything was great, and I was an artist, and yeah, so it has been a long road. It's been wonderful. I think I feel lucky every day to come, and my clients have been great.
Well, and I gather the way this field works, there are a lot of people who are new to the field. What do we understand about this field today that 100 years ago or 50 years ago or 30 years ago that we didn't?
I think it's exactly what Ashley just said, in that it is able to help people in ways that traditional models of counseling or therapies would normally help. Yeah.
Okay, well, so we're in the studio, and can you kind of describe the space we are and really what happens here?
Sure. Right now, we're sitting in what is the community area, and this is a place where we invite the public in once a week to create art with art therapy interns that we have here on staff or volunteer art therapists who staff the space.
As in, people are here for non-therapeutic reasons or therapeutic reasons that they don't have to necessarily get into? Or
yeah, therapeutic reasons that they don't necessarily have to disclose, and they don't need a diagnosis to be able to join in on that particular experience. And so it's an opportunity for the general public to engage in art therapy. And it goes beyond just that. In some ways, therapy in general, lots of different therapies, treatment of any kind is very privileged a lot of times to people who have insurance or who have jobs who can pay the out-of-pocket fees for those things. And so part of what Bloom's mission is to be able to provide opportunities to engage in art therapy for everybody.
So this is the community room. There are a number of smaller rooms that go off of this space.
Yeah, and those rooms, we typically do individual family, small group private sessions. And we have four different therapists here who see people all throughout the week in those sessions. And people pay out of pocket. They pay through their insurance. And we're also very excited to start working with Wraparound Care in Milwaukee.
How does someone know, you know, someone who's dealing with something, whether it's a mental illness issue or trauma or some other issue that would bring them to a therapist, that art is an appropriate and would be a useful part of the therapy for them?
I think some people know and some people don't know. I think some people seek us out. I'm finding that more and more people seek us out because they have heard of art therapy. They go online, they look up what's available in Milwaukee, and they come upon us. And so more and more our referrals are coming for that specifically because they already know that they enjoy it. But what I've also seen is that, especially as I began my practice 15 years ago, that people came, and when we built a trusting relationship and I would ask them to do something creatively, they realized it got them out of their thinking brain and more into just allowing things to happen and seeing things visually. And so it was a different way of thinking, and it allowed them to access more things that maybe were guarded or that just weren't even available to them.
Is this the same thing or something different than the idea of mindfulness, say?
I think it's very similar to mindfulness, actually. I think that it's mindfulness in a different way. And there was actually an article that I just posted on Bloom's website or Facebook page about how art making is like meditating. And I think that from what I know of being a therapist and an art therapist, a lot of what we're doing is helping people create awareness. And it's the means or the approach that you do that with that changes.
You have to be open. You know, a lot of people sometimes when they hear art therapy have no idea what it is. So they're like thinking either we're an art teacher or that you're going to draw a picture and we're going to tell you what's wrong with you. And that is absolutely not what it is. So the people that walk in the door have to be open to, you know, being vulnerable and trying these new things. And that's why it's so important for us as clinicians to, like, you know, create that safe environment. Like Emily said, it is almost a form of mindfulness. Like when you get into the zone of making art, this happens almost on a daily basis in my office. All of a sudden, I'll look up at the clock and say, holy cow, that was already 45. Like, we got to clean up. And the kids always say, that went so fast. Like, I didn't even realize that our time was done. So I think that that kind of speaks to that, you know, being in like kind of a Zen moment where you lose everything and everything gets poured onto whatever you're creating at that time.
So let me ask you this. I mean, you know, you look in your office and you've got art supplies and a table covered in brown paper where people are presumably doing art, and you also have a comfortable chair and a comfortable couch. How do you go from, you know, I'm dealing with X to let's make art?
Yeah, so a lot of times what happens for me is that the client will come in and will initially sit down. And a lot of times I realize that the kids go and they sit right at the table because they're ready to make art. But a lot of times the adults will come in and they'll sit on the couch and I'll sit in the chair and I'll just say, so tell me what's gone on with you since we've seen each other last. And we'll have what I call a check-in. And during that time, I'm assessing what's going on with the client and what might be helpful to do in this moment. And so then I'm also thinking about, okay, so what art task can I give this particular person that's going to help them right now? But then also thinking about what our long-term goals are and the goals that we, myself and the client, have created together. At that point, I'll say, okay, so this is what I'm thinking, and I'll give the client a choice and say, is that something you're interested in doing? Let's move over to the table. And then we'll move over to the table and we'll start creating whatever it is. And I sometimes will join and sometimes I will watch, depending on sort of what the client needs at that time.
Sometimes you'll join, meaning?
I'll make art too, yeah.
It almost sounds like you have, for lack of a better term, a matrix in your head.
For me, yeah, my brain really works that way. I'm sort of ruling things out as we're going and talking about them, and I'm very systematic and very much like, okay, so, but then also too, there's an intuitive side of it as well, but that's intuitive with clinical knowledge. And so when I'm making art next to the client too, I'm making art for the client.
You know, one of our biggest talents, or whatever you want to call it, is being able to be flexible. And so, you know, sometimes you'll have maybe an art directive or specific material set out of things that, hey, I thought this would work, this would be a good thing to do with this client. But when they come in, they're going to tell you exactly what they need. So, I mean, sometimes they'll verbally just say, like, I need to sit down and talk to you. Or sometimes their actions will show, this isn't exactly what we should be doing today.
Help me understand, when you are making art alongside the clients and you're making it for the client, how are they using what you are making?
I have an example actually in the other room, and I can talk about this experience with a client. So I had a client who, mostly nonverbal, had experienced severe sexual abuse as a young kid, and I had seen him for years and he was still very, very nonverbal, and it was very difficult to get him to talk. Not that he couldn't talk, it was just not something he did. And so he had painted a picture with some stencils and of a tree. And as I was painting with him, I was painting a portion of the tree. And when it came to the end of the session and we were finished, and we always put up our paintings side by side and look at them together up on the board that we have, and I said, well, you know, what do you think? And he usually nodded, you know, he would nod and say, oh, yeah, it's good. I would say, well, you know, I'm going to tell you about my picture. I said, this is a picture of a part of a tree. And this is me wanting to be a part and to be let into where your branches are and to be a part of this. And it was kind of like building that trust with him. Hey, I'm safe. I want to be a part of this, and I'm here, and I'm here with you.
Do each of you recognize the therapeutic nature when you're making art yourself, for yourself?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Not to put too fine a point on it.
No, yes. I actually, in my bag, have my visual journals, and I keep them with me pretty much at all times. I do, and I recognize that when I have an overwhelming feeling or I'm dealing with something, the thing that I need to do absolutely the most is to go through and make my own art. Yeah.
Are there times as art therapists and professional counselors that you take a step back and say, maybe art isn't the best output or isn't the best way to get at these issues you're going through?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's my personal belief that the client can sort of lead me in where they want to go. Sometimes I can tell that they need to be pushed a little bit, and then I'll, if they're resistant to art, sometimes I can tell that it would be really helpful, and I'll try to get them maybe more interested in it. But I never force. It's not, at least for me, it's not a requirement.
There's no, you will do a watercolor and it will be good for you.
No, not at all. That's not my style. I'm not forceful in that way. Not at all.
How do you know that you have done this right? How do you know that you've been able to help someone?
They keep coming back. They get better, and they meet their goals. I mean, we have a treatment plan. Mm-hmm. It's not like we're just,
right,
you know, kind of pulling out the art supplies and sitting and making art. We have goals, and it's very systematic. I have a client who came for therapy and was very hesitant. So there's ways that we can see that she's expanding and growing. Like, she would work on really small pieces of paper at first. She was super nervous about what it was going to look like and how to use the materials. And she just came in last week and wanted to use huge paper. We were doing all new materials. She was like super into it. And there was no hesitation there at all. And she was able to notice that she wasn't judging herself. She wasn't being negative. She was super open to the process. And she told me this whole story about how she was with a bunch of friends and they were doing this group kind of like, oh, making onesies for babies, you know, at a little shower or something. And she was like, I was like leading everybody. I was totally utilizing all those things that we've talked about to not judge myself, not worry too much, to go with the process. So you can see through the actual art materials alongside of the treatment goals that we've set for them, which are much more like clinically worded than, oh, she's using larger paper. But even that is something that we would notice and assess and be like, oh, you're not trying to control everything so much. It doesn't have to be this tiny piece of paper and really rigid.
She felt some freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What areas does the research need to go for this field to keep expanding?
There's a lot of different psychological theory approaches that are integrated with the art and art therapy. And I think the direction that we're moving towards and that my research goes in the direction of is trying to create a unified theory of art therapy and really understanding what happens, what are the phenomenological things that happen. And so my research right now is about, okay, so this isn't a private practice and it isn't an art studio, it's an art therapy studio. So this is what I call a liminal space. And so in that liminal space, what happens in it?
Does the reality of this work gel with what you were hoping when you decided to combine your interest in art and your interest in helping people?
It's even better than I imagined. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think for me, working a lot with kids is really rewarding, and, you know, having them walk in and be excited to come to therapy at 6, 7 years old makes me feel like something right's going on in there, you know. And essentially you're giving them all these different tools that they can use and transform to their own for the rest of their life, and that's pretty cool.
You have all these like aha moments and just great moments with your clients where you can see that things are clicking and they're getting things and they're moving forward. And of course there's hard days too, and sometimes you feel like it's sort of a thankless job at times, but overall you feel that you're helping people and that they're making some progress in their life, and that's incredibly rewarding for sure.
Well, thank you to all three of you. Best of luck in your work.
Thank you. It was nice to talk with you.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Nice meeting you.
Thanks so much for being here, Mitch.
Emily Nolan, Ashley Smallwood, and Caitlin Walsh are art therapists at Bloom Center for Art and Integrated Therapies in Bayview. You can see photos from their studio at WUWM.com. Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It's been 33 years, and Russell Panchenko is retiring. The director and chief curator of the Chazen Museum in Madison has worked hard during those past three decades to make the museum a welcoming place for town and gown.
But getting patrons in the door has sometimes been a challenge, so Panchenko decided to go out with a bang. Samurai, the Way of the Warrior is a collection of more than 90 objects, including armor, swords, saddles, and lacquered objects from the Museo Stibert in Florence, Italy.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Panchenko tells contributor Jennifer Fields that this kind of exhibit appeals to a wide audience. He hopes the audience will ask more questions about Japanese history and explore some of the other objects in the museum's collection, like the 4,500-plus Japanese prints and its growing ceramic collection.
You have to look at this carefully. You can look at the overall and you see the warrior's armor and samurai armor, but then you start going up close and spending time. In fact, almost all art is like that, where you've got to spend a lot of time and look and look and look. You know, people keep coming in and saying, I want a label. Why don't you put labels out there? And I say, forget the labels. Then I'm telling you what I know about it or I saw there. Why don't you just come in? Don't worry about what somebody else thinks. Just look at it and say, what do you think? What do you see? And spend the time. You'd be surprised how much you see, and you don't see it as well if somebody else tells you. Whereas if you spend the time and you look, you acquire a lot of new knowledge. 90% of the people coming through our doors are not art history students. They don't want to be preach to about art history. They've come in because there's something about the visual arts that's kind of intrigued them. They have their own interests, and what you have to do as a museum specialist is help them explore it and indulge it. It doesn't mean that we stop doing things with art history, but if we've got a much bigger audience, then you've got to sort of say, why are they coming in the door? What do they want? How can we help them achieve it?
So then what do you say to people who don't necessarily think or believe that they will be represented or be able to see something of themselves in a museum? How do you reach those people?
Well, first thing you have to ask is, how do you define yourself? I grew up Ukrainian American. And you know, although we live in the States, I only went out with Ukrainian friends, only dated Ukrainian girls. We spoke Ukrainian, and Ukrainian art was supposed to be the only thing we were interested in. And yes, there is a great validity in that. But at a certain time, there's who I am and what I want to look at. I start going around and saying, okay, I'm not denying who I am, but what else is there? Who else is there that lives next door to me? Or who else, if you like history, or if you want to do some traveling and you've been, let's say, in Italy and you see some wonderful things, do you reject them because they're not Ukrainian or my heritage? Or do you say, well, I don't like everything, but gee, that somehow speaks to me.
Well, I wonder, though, if you don't necessarily reject the objects themselves, but you reject the institution for not paying attention to who you know, to who you are, or on all the facets of what you represent and want to see. Does that make any sense?
Yes, perfect sense. But I'm going to go back and say something about myself and my prejudice. And not all museum people or curators would agree with me, but my thing is, and I guess I'm a traditionalist in that way. Is it well made? Is it well done? What it says or what it talks about shouldn't come first, it comes second. For me, an artist's authority is, this person has learned how to draw. Wow, this person can draw like nobody else. Now, they're then going to use that skill to talk about something. They can talk about whatever they want. You know, it's like a book. A novel, you read them because first the person has this skill with language they've developed and a way to speak to people. Once they've got that, they talk about what they want to talk about. And that's what's valid. And so to me, the same thing, I'm happy to have things from whatever part of the world, whatever point in history, if it's artistic, let's say special, in the making of it, it's something outstanding, then what are the other aspects to it?
It's going to change, probably.
Of course.
Get ready, Russell. It's going to change, but I think that's what art can do. It can create a space where we can see your vision, we can understand what's happened in the past, and we can make predictions or make hopes for the future. It's not a stagnant thing. Mm-hmm.
To me, the quality of language, drawing, painting, that's what brings you together. If one only has a viewpoint, and let's face it, nobody's brain dead. Everybody, every person that walks the streets has ideas, has feelings, has whatever. But if I start just focusing on their feelings and their idea, then certainly those people who disagree with them, as a museum director, I'm sort of dividing people. And if I want to bring people together, what can I bring them together with is the skill and the achievement of that skill and bringing that skill to a high level. Okay, then I can say to people, I'll give you a case in point. One day when we did an exhibition of paintings from the Uffizi, and the opening was that it was a very humanistic, venerable old university professor took me aside and said, how can you put all this religious stuff in here? You know, these are all just, and he was totally opposed. And I said, I'm not bringing them in here because they're telling Bible stories. Look at how these people paint. Now, they could be talking about paganism, they can be talking about Christianity, they can be talking, look what they can do and how they say what they have to say. That's what I'm about.
And I think that one of the reasons why, we call the little tags that you see up by pieces of tombstones. I think one of the reasons why I'm glad to see those go is that I would see people walk into an art museum, look at the tag, just glance at the piece and then leave. It's like, you've got it wrong, you've got it wrong. Well, spend time with the piece, it'll tell you what you want to know.
You know, somebody once did a study and sort of equated with one of the big museums in New York as to how many visitors went through a particular number of galleries and how much time they spent going through that number of galleries and how many works there were, and then equating the amount of time in relationship to the number of works, and I found it was like, you know, 20 seconds between works. Now, it's not entirely fair, it's a statistical fact, because some pieces people would spend more time with, and others they would just walk by, but still, most people spend relatively little amount of time looking. You know, I've gotten to an age where I think about how much time I'm going to spend on my feet. You know, I used to be 3-4 hours, didn't matter, whoopee, whatever. You know, now I'm going to be on my feet for an hour, and so a lot of people would be like that. They'll be here for an hour. In that hour, what do I want them to do? Do I want them to look, or do I want them to read? I want them to look. Look at the scabbard. Look at that. It's wood, but you know, all those tiny little animals, there's snails, little snakes, little insects, you know, wow. You know, just looking at them, somebody worked that out. It's beautiful. It's
right.
Absolutely. And it doesn't, you know, for you to look at it and say, oh, that's wood, yeah. And oh, look at those, you know, that's a cicada. That's a little tiny snail made out of mother of pearl. You know, you can recognize that. We have a lot of information in our heads, you know, just, oh, look.
And then you create this narrative rather than being told what you should be focusing on. You can create your own narrative and start to see the person who would have wielded this and carried it and why. It sort of gives you permission to dream and wonder and use your own methods of critical thinking.
You know, critical thinking is a bit scary, but you know, just ask questions. You know, see, why did they do that?
If there is a lesson to be learned when we're trying to talk to particularly young people about the importance of art, art history, the importance of being able to use your visual skills to collect information, is that it's not necessarily something that has a beginning, a middle, or an end. Mm-hmm. It's a forever process. Because I can imagine when you close your door for the last time, you're not going to be like, burn all these books, I'm done.
No.
You know, I think that's when I talk about how do we reach audiences, when I talk about how do we bring people in who don't see themselves fitting in to a museum setting, it's piquing that curiosity.
It's piquing their curiosity, but also what I sort of believe in is give kids or introduce them into making. You know, give them a pencil and paper. Give them a try. Hey, look how this guy person drew that apple. Can you do that? Now, some are going to fall down and say, yawn, but others. And it's when you start making and you suddenly realize it's not simple and straightforward. You don't just whip it out. And then some kids take it as a challenge, say, I'm gonna do that. You know, that's the beginning. And then they go look at the apple, they appreciate, oh God, I tried. I couldn't do that, or I'm gonna do it better. It's the making of art that for me is what it's all about. Trying to do it, you realize suddenly what that other person out there who's in a museum accomplished. That's, to me, that's the important bridge.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
Two, one.
Welcome to Exfabula!
True personal story.
Exfabula!
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
It is a holiday weekend in Milwaukee. This is Exfabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend on WWM. I'm Bruce Winter with Exfabula co-founder Leah Delaney. So much going on this weekend. 4th of July holiday coming up. Summerfest going on. So much to do and be in Milwaukee. Good to see you.
Oh, good to see you too. How goes it?
It is going good. And, you know, I'm looking forward to hot fun in the summertime.
Yeah. You got any special plans this weekend?
Not yet. But, you know,
some very non-special plans?
I tend to ad lib.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Like right now, how we're doing.
Exactly. No script. That's my life. No script.
Yeah, it's always very exciting. Yes, you are so right. I did bring more stories with a new theme this holiday weekend. We have some changes going on in the background of Exfabula, which is so exciting for everyone. Oh, well, I'm going to break the news. We have new board members that are entering the Exfabula board in the next month or so. Raina Johnson and Megan Coven are stepping up. Megan is actually taking over for Bob Pothier as our new Exfabula board president. So Big round of applause for her. She's been ultimately a fantastic supporter of our mission for a long time, as well as Raina Johnson. The lovely Raina Johnson is stepping into our secretarial position. So again, huge supporters of our mission to create better bonds, tighter community bonds in Milwaukee.
And you guys just continue to grow with only the things you do for story slams and public events, but things you do behind the scenes too. So.
Yeah, trying to keep Milwaukee as strong as possible through the art of storytelling. Raina Johnson is going to start out our show today. She told a story at our Only in Milwaukee event. So let's listen to Raina Johnson's Only in Milwaukee story.
I'm 31 years old, and about 5 years ago, I got a driver's license for the first time. I grew up in Milwaukee with my mom, and my mom didn't drive either. So everywhere we went, we took the bus. I have two older siblings, and actually I was told that my mom went into labor with me on the bus taking my siblings to the zoo. So the bus has been our friend for a very long time. So I grew up here, took the bus everywhere, because that was the only thing that I knew, and I didn't have a means when I turned 16 to really learn how to drive. So I grow up, you know, I go through life, I get a bachelor's degree, I had a child, he's sitting over there in the corner. But I never got a license. And so I started dating this guy, and he's like, wow, you've done so much, you've accomplished so much in your life. And there's this one little thing that I just couldn't quite get to, which was a valid Wisconsin driver's license. So he's like, well, that's strange. So he lets me drive his, 2009 Toyota Camry. It was silver, had four doors. And he's like, you should really learn how to drive in my car. And I was like, this is great, sure. So first we started out driving around his neighborhood on the north side. And I got a little cocky, maybe. And so we scheduled a road test. I was super excited about it. And I remember I took off work because I was like, I have to go do this. This is a big deal for me. So took off work. I like literally took the whole day off because I had to like mentally prepare for this process. And so took the day off. We go to the DMV. I'm like, I'm ready. We're going to do this. I'm going to get a driver's license today. So I went all the way to like 55th and Grange. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? It's very like residential, very nice, quiet, very pretty over there. So I go, I get in this car, and the instructor, she, you know, we walk out to the car together, and I'm like, I bet you've never had anyone as old as me take a road test. And she's like, honey, you're fine. I've had people older than you, but just, you know, calm down, you're gonna be fine. So we get in the car, we start driving around. I'm like distracted by all of the houses, and I, and she's like, okay, now parallel park. Nope. Nope, to this day. Nope, I would drive around and around and around and not going to parallel park. So eventually we get back to the DMV, and she says, you need to work on your parking, like in general and parallel parking, but you passed. And I was like, great, that's so wonderful. Here I am with a bachelor's degree and a baby, and I was thinking about going to graduate school, and now I have a driver's license. I felt like a real adult. It was wonderful. I was 26, this was great. So the following day, my then boyfriend says, hey, you can take my car to work, and I'll drive my truck. And I was like, cool, I can sleep in a little bit, maybe wake up. Actually, no, I can wake up a little earlier, and I can go to Starbucks, and I can read the newspaper. I have all this extra time in the morning before I go to work, right? Because I'll have a car. Because I was so used to just hustling on the bus, right? So I'm driving, and I'm like, yeah, it's early in the morning. It's like probably 7 o'clock, and I'm like on my way. I was like, I know how to get to Starbucks. I got landmarks because I can't drive and do the Google map thing on my phone. And so I was like, I know where I'm going. I got my landmarks, right? I'm headed to Starbucks, and I'm driving down Fond du Lac. It's pretty busy. It was winter, and I get ready to turn. So I'm gonna make a left-hand turn, missed it, and crashed into a light pole. So the car, the tire, went into the pole with the light, and I tried to reverse really quickly, and it didn't work. So the police were called. The traffic lights on this super busy intersection at 7 o'clock in the morning didn't work anymore. The police came, a tow truck came, and I said, officer, I just got my license yesterday. And he said, ma'am, people do that all the time. And I'm like, no, really, check the date. It was yesterday afternoon, not even 24 hours ago. And so he felt bad for me, so they waited with me. Luckily, I wasn't injured. My son wasn't in the car, so that's good. But I don't drive very much now. And that boyfriend, well, I paid his deductible, and he got his car fixed, and we're not together anymore. So that's my only Milwaukee story, and I love our public transportation system. Thank you.
And that was Raina Johnson's story from our Only in Milwaukee event.
You know, for some people, learning how to drive a car comes real easy. Others, you know, you just never get it. And so, like she said at the end of her story, I ride the bus a lot. So
yeah.
That's great.
You know, I'm going to segue into a little something we have going on with our Exfabula website right now. Per usual, we are voting on season 9 themes. We have a whole bunch of themes that we have set up at exfabula.org that we want to welcome Milwaukee to chime in their thoughts on it. A couple of the themes that we have, maybe this will help people, you know, get their brains going about their personal stories, but try again.
Ooh, I like that.
Karma, TMI, last straw, connections, in plain sight, 3 is a crowd, a whole bunch of more to choose from here. But
I thought of at your own risk.
At your own risk. I think the voting ends on July 21st. Don't quote me on that, Milwaukee, but please go to exfabula.org to confirm this information and to vote.
All right.
All right, so let's move it along. We have another Only in Milwaukee story coming up from Megan Coven. Let's listen to Megan's story about her experience with Only in Milwaukee.
So I grew up in Milwaukee. I grew up by the old county stadium. And that parking lot, was a big part of my childhood and adolescence. My family and I, we used to walk the dog down there. I learned how to drive and parallel park in that parking lot when there wasn't a game going on. I also learned how to drive my mom's stick shift in that parking lot, not always successfully. And in high school, when you leave the house that I grew up in, you go down the street and there was like this bank of bushes, trees and whatnot. And you get in there and kind of scale down a hill and you'd land down this walkway underpass into the parking lot, kind of where all the pedestrians used to be funneled from, what was that, Mitchell Park or whatever that parkway is that would kick you up over onto Blue Mound. Okay, so, I used to hide things in these woods, whether it was a pack of cigarettes to sneak, smokes when I was young. When I got older, I had the brilliant idea of stealing some beer out of my parents' refrigerator and then going and finding an empty log to put the cans of beer to hide it for later. And, miraculously, I came back and they were gone. And, I wanted to, I can't go to the police. It was such an injustice. But I would probably say the worst, the biggest amount of trouble that I got into in that parking lot had to do in high school. After I had learned how to drive a car and specifically drive my mom's stick car, it was what kind of car was it? It was like a Dodge Colt. Four-door, tin can, baby, weird blue color. And my boyfriend and I, I drove us down to that empty parking lot when there was no game, and we started making out, and things got a little hot and heavy, and some clothing came off, and the windows fogged up. It's gotten dark out now. It's very romantic in teenager terms, and things are happening in the passenger side of the car, and all of a sudden this bright light comes in and on the window. Well, my boyfriend freaked out, and he like jumps off of me, jumps into the driver's seat, does not know how to drive stick, and we tear out of there in first gear, 30 miles an hour or whatever. And I am laughing like a crazy person. Like, I think this whole thing is hilarious because I look back and it's not the cops. It's the county stadium security team, which at the time consisted of like 80-year-old men driving around in a golf cart. Very harmless, whatever. But my boyfriend doesn't know any of this. He is not from this neighborhood and it thinks that the cops are out to get him. And like I said, we are like flying off at 30 miles an hour in first gear, and I am praying that he doesn't break my mom's car, but laughing all the way. He was not laughing one bit. As a matter of fact, his pallor had really gotten pale, and honestly, I couldn't understand why he was so upset. I mean, we were just a couple of kids having some fun, and it wasn't really until probably a year or two ago that I learned about white privilege and what that means here in Milwaukee, that it suddenly dawned on me that my African-American boyfriend had a very different experience than I did in this situation. To him, this was an incredibly scary scenario, and there I am laughing my head off like a dumb white girl. And it really got me thinking about how there are some wonderful things from my past and my childhood that have only, they are Milwaukee. They are only in Milwaukee. But so is the differences in the racial injustice that exists in this city, and how it permeates and impacts every single one of us as Milwaukee citizens. Thank you.
And that was Megan Coven's story, Only in Milwaukee, at a story slam that took place at 3041 North.
Mm-hmm. Don't you love how that story just turns? What was going along as you thought was just a story about the misadventures of youth, and then it becomes an adult realization. Just like, and the story, she did such a great job. I love it.
Yes, indeed. You know, when people think about their stories and how to construct them, the turning points are so necessary just to kind of keep people engaged and turning in different directions. And this was a really monumental direction to turn to, especially when we are dealing with Milwaukee and the issues that we have at hand. So fantastic job, Megan. And I also want to, again, congratulate Raina Johnson coming in, stepping in as secretary of a board, and of course, Megan Coven stepping in as our ex-fabula board president.
Can I ask you about story constructs? Are you guys still planning on doing some of those?
Workshops?
Workshops, yeah, during the year?
Yes, we will, yeah. Okay. You know, this summer, we're kind of taking a little bit of time off and kind of getting geared up for season 9 story slams and events and our fellowship series and our storytelling workshops. But people will just need to keep it in mind to go to our website. Got a couple seconds, check out what's going on.
Right.
And also, I will be here to remind everybody as well, whether you like it or not.
You will hear from her, believe me, yes. All right. Well, thanks for coming in today and bringing the stories. And if you want to share today's stories with someone or hear them again, they are posted at WUWM.com.
X Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned now for Weekend All Things Considered, coming up next. It is 4 o'clock.
What are teenagers doing today? They're trying every thriller is in the books.